Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 7th, 2022 Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Sanctioned Tent Camp Program Could Expand, written by Joe Rubino. Prison Fosters Culture of Abuse, written by Michael Balsamo and Michael Sizek of the Associated Press. And Hazardous Forever Chemicals Used in State for Fracking by Judith Kohler. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Sanctioned Tent Camp Program Could Expand. Safe Outdoor Spaces sites are up for $3.9 million contract extension by Joe Rubino. For Denver City Councilwoman Robin Nash, it's obvious the best way to help people overcome homelessness is to skip over emergency shelters entirely and get them straight into stable housing. But facing the reality that the number of people who need help is far greater than the city's capacity to add housing for them, she is willing to support stopgap solutions. The Safe Outdoor Spaces sanctioned camping sites model is a key tool the city needs to embrace, she believes. Our goal is to save lives, improve stability of people, and to minimize disruptions to communities from unsheltered homelessness, Nash said at a committee hearing last month. For our city to meet those goals, this is critical. The Colorado Village Collaborative will be before the City Council on Monday night seeking a $3.9 million contract extension to continue operating and expand on its Safe Outdoor Spaces model through the end of 2022. The money at stake is federal, coming from Denver's American Rescue Plan Act funding. Using ice fishing tents on properties outfitted with power, portable toilets, hand washing stations, and regularly visited by service providers, the nonprofit says it has helped 47 people transition from homelessness to more stable housing since getting up and running in December 2020. With a contract that would provide a more than fourfold increase over the roughly $900,000 the city has given the program to date, the organization projects it will be able to shelter 370 people over the course of 2022 and aims to get 90 of them into stable housing. The contract would allow Colorado Village Collaborative to expand from 3 sites now to 4 at some point during the year. It would also provide money for new employees dedicated to helping residents navigate the resources available to them and to provide peer support, representatives say. Denver officials recently participated in a point-in-time count of people staying in emergency shelters and living in tents, cars, and other situations deemed unfit for human habitation. Those people are classified as unsheltered. The results of the count won't be released until later this year, but a rough estimate from 2021 indicated that close to 1,200 people were living on the streets unsheltered. The Safe Outdoor Spaces model would often referred to as SOS, is still growing and evolving, but Kucha Montoya, who manages the program for the Colorado Village Collaborative, can't help but speculate on what it could do with more support. 2 50-person sites in each of Denver's 11 city council districts would provide the capacity to give almost every unsheltered person the option to live in one, she said. People want to see change around unsheltered homelessness, and this would be it, she said. We need city council to approve this contract. That's the first step. For some opponents, the risks outweigh those projected rewards. Terry Hildebrandt, a resident and business owner in the Golden Triangle neighborhood who regularly speaks at city council meetings about homelessness issues, voiced his opposition to the sites during a recent public comment session. In the speech, reproduced in an email sent out by the group Citizens for a Safe and Clean Denver, Hildebrandt called for stricter rules at the sites. He wants Colorado Village Collaborative to check residents' tents and bags for drugs and alcohol, which are banned under the site's community guidelines. City Council, before you spend another $3.9 million with CVC, require more accountability from Executive Director Cole Chandler and his staff, Hildebrand said. Require regulations for tent inspections and monitoring at the city-funded SOS camps to ensure they are drug-free. Require more unannounced inspections by city regulators to check for drugs with drug-sniffing dogs. Don McNulty, 47, lives in the Baker neighborhood. The historic part of town has not hosted a sanctioned campsite, but the Neighborhood Association Board voted 13-2 in August in favor of supporting one if a suitable location could be identified. McNulty's two children both attend schools within walking distance of the site that opened at 780 Ilotti Street near the Denver Health Medical Center campus in November. The lack of legally enforceable rules around how the Colorado Village Collaborative works with and is responsible for the people who live around the sites upsets McNulty. So does the lack of transparency around the potential criminal histories of the people living in the sites, she said. She feels the City Council and Mayor Michael Hancock's office has failed to adequately protect residents and businesses from the potential negative consequences. This is a bipartisan issue, and well-intentioned, compassionate people are working on both sides, she said. We need to band together as a city. We must demand more of our city public officials. This cannot be a $3.9 million check without several stipulations and public health and safety assurances. McNulty has developed a list of 9 points of considerations she wants to see addressed around every SOS site. They include setting specific lease term limits, limits on the number of residents, firm rules around proximity to schools, proximity to businesses, and mandatory disclosure of any criminal or health risk incidents in the sites. Some of these points are already covered in the nonprofit's agreements with property owners hosting sites. Montoya was chosen to be the Safe Outdoor Spaces program manager in part because of her past. She has been homeless and gone through challenges with her mental health, substance misuse, and the criminal justice system, she said. A key pillar of the SOS model is being low barrier so that people who might otherwise sleep in unsanctioned encampments will come into the sites, gain some stability, and hopefully start to move toward stable housing. A big part of that is respecting privacy, Montoya said. What we do is provide a safe space that respects their dignity and human autonomy, she said. We have community guidelines, which are no drugs and no alcohol on site, but we also don't invade people's private space. Privacy, as well as allowing couples to stay together and people to keep their pets with them in their tents, are unique parts of the SOS model that make it an important part of the city's shelter options, officials say. It was because of the limitations of group shelters that officials went looking for something like them when the COVID-19 pandemic arrived. 75-year-old Gary Peters is among the residents living in the SOS site on the Denver Human Services East office campus at 3815 Steele Street. The military veteran has income from his retirement, but spent 7 years living at his own campsite before moving into an SOS tent in late 2020. He had a stroke last year that has hampered his mobility, and he is now working with the Department of Veterans Affairs to get a housing voucher. He previously had housing through the VA, but preferred to be by himself, which is why he was camping. The SOS site has been a key bridge for him while he recovers from his stroke. I have no choice, he said while sitting in his tent Friday. I mean, I couldn't walk to my campsite. This is shelter, definitely shelter. The contract extension hasn't won over every council member. District 5 City Councilwoman Amanda Sawyer has repeatedly opposed investing public money in the sites. At last month's committee hearing, she questioned if the $3.9 million would be better spent on renovations to city-owned group shelter buildings to provide more privacy in them. I'm just not 100% convinced, based on the lack of information and numbers on the finances, that this is something the city should be investing in, Sawyer said during the committee hearing. This is certainly something, if private investors and private locations are interested in pursuing it, then it is in our zoning code, and that makes sense. In that same meeting, District 1 Councilwoman Amanda Sandoval said she heard repeatedly from constituents that the SOS site on the Regis University campus has been a worthwhile investment of their tax dollars compared to funding sweeps of encampments downtown. The lease for that site was scheduled to expire in March. If you find another place in Council District 1, please feel free to reach out to me, Sandoval said. I look forward to that partnership. I am sad to see you leaving so soon. The Colorado Village Collaborative has since worked out an extension to stay on the Regis campus through June, Montoya said. That site, run in partnership with the St. Francis Center, had seen at least 11 people transition into housing, with another dozen in the pipeline, according to St. Francis Center Executive Director Tom Lors. If Gerald Horner and Ryan Cox had their way, the Safe Outdoor Spaces contract would be much larger. Adding one more site in 2022 is not moving fast enough to address the crisis of unsanctioned encampments in their Curtis Park neighborhood in Five Points, the two men say. Cox is the president of the Curtis Park Neighbors Registered Neighborhood Association. Theft, open-air drug dealing, and fires breaking out in encampments are now daily concerns in the neighborhood. That is why the Curtis Park Neighbors has partnered with 12 other groups to push for SOS sites in all 11 city council districts. What we want people to understand is there is not another alternative right now that is showing any effectiveness, Horner said. Prison fosters culture of abuse. Women say allegations were ignored. Some were punished for reporting misconduct, by Michael Balsamo and Michael Sizek of the Associated Press. Inside one of the only federal women's prisons in the United States, inmates say they have been subjected to rampant sexual abuse by correctional officers and even the warden, and were often threatened or punished when they tried to speak up. Prisoners and workers at the Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin, California, even have a name for it, the Rape Club. An Associated Press investigation has found a permissive and toxic culture at the Bay Area lockup, enabling years of sexual misconduct by predatory employees and cover-ups that have largely kept the abuse out of the public eye. The AP obtained internal Federal Bureau of Prisons documents, statements, and recordings from inmates, interviewed current and former prison employees and inmates, and reviewed thousands of pages of court records from criminal and civil cases involving Dublin prison staff. Together, they detail how inmates' allegations against members of the mostly male staff were ignored or set aside, how prisoners could be sent to solitary confinement for reporting abuse, and how officials in charge of preventing and investigating sexual misconduct were themselves accused of abusing inmates or neglecting their concerns. In one instance, a female inmate said a man who was her prison work supervisor taunted her by remarking, "Let the games begin," when he assigned her to work with a maintenance foreman she accused of rape. Another worker claimed he wanted to get inmates pregnant. The warden, the man in charge of Dublin, kept nude photos on his government-issued cell phone of a woman he is accused of assaulting. One inmate said she was overwhelmed with fear, anxiety, and anger, and cried uncontrollably after enduring abuse and retaliation at Dublin. Another said she contemplated suicide when her cries for help went unheeded, and now suffers from severe anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder. All sexual activity between a prison worker and an inmate is illegal. Correctional employees enjoy substantial power over inmates, controlling every aspect of their lives from mealtime to lights out, and there is no scenario in which an inmate can give consent. The allegations at Dublin, which so far have resulted in 4 arrests, are endemic of a larger problem within the beleaguered Bureau of Prisons. In 2020, the same year some of the women at Dublin complained, there were 422 complaints of staff on inmate sexual abuse across the system of 122 prisons and 153,000 inmates. The agency said it substantiated only 4 of those complaints, and 290 are still being investigated. It would not say whether the allegations were concentrated in women's prisons or spread throughout the system. A hotbed of corruption and misconduct, the federal prison system has been plagued by myriad crises in recent years, including widespread criminal activity among employees, critically low staffing levels that have hampered responses to emergencies, the rapid spread of COVID-19, a failed response to the pandemic, and dozens of escapes. Last month, the embattled director, Michael Carvajal, announced he was resigning. Last week, 2 inmates were killed in a gang clash at a federal penitentiary in Texas, prompting a nationwide lockdown. The AP contacted lawyers for every Dublin prison employee charged with sexual abuse are named as a defendant in a lawsuit alleging abuse and tried reaching the men directly through available phone numbers and email addresses. None responded to interview requests. A government lawyer representing one of the men being sued declined to comment. The Hesha Juzino, taking over as Dublin's warden at the end of the month, promised to work tirelessly to reaffirm the Bureau of Prisons' zero tolerance for sexual abuse and sexual harassment. She said the agency is fully cooperating with the Justice Department's Inspector General on active investigations and noted that a vast majority of these cases were referred for investigation by the Bureau of Prisons itself. I am committed to ensuring the safety of our inmates, staff, and the public, Juzino said in a statement to the AP. A culture of misconduct or actions not representative of the BOP's core values will not be tolerated. The Justice Department said in a statement, zero tolerance means exactly that. The Justice Department is committed to both holding accountable any staff who violate their position of trust and to preventing these crimes from happening in the first place. FCI Dublin, about 21 miles east of Oakland, was opened in 1974. It was converted in 2012 to one of six women-only facilities in the federal prison system. Actresses Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman both served time there for their involvement in a college admissions bribery scandal. As of Tuesday, it had about 750 inmates, many serving sentences for drug crimes. There are increasingly more women behind bars, but they are still a minority, only about 6.5% of the overall federal inmate population. Union officials say the vast majority of Dublin employees are honest and hardworking and are upset that the allegations and actions of some workers have tarnished the prison's reputation. We have a diversified staff. We have veterans. We have ex-law enforcement. We have good people, and they're very traumatized, Dublin Union President Ed Canali said. Inmates and prison workers who spoke to the AP did not want their names published for fear of retaliation. The AP also does not typically identify people who say they are victims of sexual assault unless they grant permission. Women made the first internal complaints to staff members about 5 years ago, court records and internal agency documents show, but it's not clear whether those complaints ever went anywhere. The women say they were largely ignored and the abuse continued. One inmate who reported a 2017 sexual assault said she was told nothing would be done about her complaint because it was a he said, she said. The woman who is now suing the Bureau of Prisons over her treatment said she was fired from her prison commissary job as retaliation. When she went to report her firing, she said a Dublin counselor took her abuser's side, responding, "Child, do you want him to lose his job?" The woman was moved to a different prison a week later. In 2019, another Dublin inmate sued, first on her own with handwritten papers, then with the backing of a powerful San Francisco law firm, alleging that a maintenance foreman repeatedly raped her and that other workers facilitated the abuse and mocked her for it. When an internal prison investigator finally caught wind of what was happening, the woman said she was the one who got punished, with 3 months in solitary confinement and a transfer to a federal prison in Alabama. Then in 2020, another inmate's report that Dublin workers were abusing inmates broke through to the Justice Department's Inspector General and the FBI, triggering a criminal investigation that has led to the arrest of four employees, including former warden Ray J. Garcia, in the past 7 months. They each face up to 15 years in prison, though in their recent cases, sentences have ranged from 3 months to 2 years. Two of the men are expected to plead guilty in the coming weeks in federal court to charges of sexual abuse of a ward. None of the men accused in civil suits has been charged with crimes. The FBI said Friday it is continuing to investigate. The former warden, arrested last September, is accused of molesting an inmate as she tried to push him away. Garcia made her and another inmate strip naked as he did rounds and took pictures that were found on his personal laptop and government-issued cell phone when the FBI raided his office and home last summer, prosecutors said. The abuse ended when the pandemic exploded and women were locked in their cells, they said. Garcia was later promoted. The Bureau of Prisons said it didn't know about the abuse until later. "If they're undressing, I've already looked," Garcia, 54, told the FBI in July 2021, according to court records. I don't like schedule a time, like you be undressed and I'll be there. Garcia, who was placed on leave after the raid and retired a month after his arrest, is also accused of using his authority to intimidate one of the victims, telling her that he was close friends with the person responsible for investigating staff misconduct and boasting that he could not be fired, prosecutors said. Ross Klinger, 36, a Dublin prison recycling technician, is scheduled to plead guilty on Thursday to charges he sexually abused at least two inmates between March and September 2020, including inside a warehouse and in a shipping container on prison grounds, while another inmate acted as a lookout. Klinger told the women he wanted to marry them and father their children, even proposing to one of them after she was discharged to a halfway house, prosecutors said. Another prisoner, aware of the abuse, reported Klinger to the Bureau of Prisons in June 2020, according to the FBI, but he was still allowed to transfer to a federal jail in San Diego months later. Despite the move, prosecutors said Klinger kept contacting one of the victims through an email address he created with a phony name, sometimes sending lewd messages referencing sexual acts, and messaged the other woman on Snapchat saying he loved her and was willing to do anything for her. Interviewed by investigators in April 2021, Klinger denied any wrongdoing, but said that because of the allegations, his life was over. Hazardous Forever Chemicals Used in State for Fracking by Judith Kohler. Long-lasting chemicals with links to cancer and other ailments have been used in Colorado to frack oil and gas wells, a National Health and Environmental Organization says in a new report. Physicians for Social Responsibility said an analysis shows that a class of chemicals called PFAs, or forever chemicals, were used in nearly 300 oil and gas wells in the state and might have been used in many more over the past decade. Besides fracking, the report said the chemicals were used in enhanced oil recovery techniques to extract oil later in a well's life. Dusty Horwitt, author of Fracking with Forever Chemicals in Colorado, said in a call Wednesday with reporters that PSR worked with an independent data scientist to analyze the chemicals reported by oil and gas companies on the Frack Focus. The database is a national registry managed by two associations of state officials. Of 12,000 Colorado wells whose fracking chemicals were listed as trade secrets on Frack Focus from 2011 to 21, more than 3,200 used surfactants, according to the report. Horwitt said the substances could have been fluorosurfactants in the PFAS family and used in fracking in other states. The use of the chemicals in Colorado could stretch back even further, Horwitt said. A 2008 article in the Open Petroleum Engineering Journal refers to fluorosurfactants used in a Moffat County well to speed up the flow of oil. Fracking or hydraulic fracturing involves injecting water, sand, and chemicals at high pressure underground to open fissures, making it easier for the oil and gas to flow. Colorado has about 49,850 active oil and gas wells. The amount of chemicals in the fracking fluid is typically very small, 1% or less of the fluid, Horwitt said, but some of these chemicals can be so toxic that even very small amounts can contaminate large amounts of drinking water and could make people sick if people were exposed. Cracks or gaps in the concrete casing the hole used to drill a well can result in fracking fluids migrating to underground water, Horwitt said. Wastewater brought up to the surface might contain the chemicals. The potential that people could be exposed and become sick is real, Horwitt said, noting that wells are increasingly being drilled near homes and schools. The PFAS chemicals, per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, have been widely used for decades by all kinds of industries for their ability to repel water and resist heat, stains, and grease. The chemicals are used in firefighting foam, food packaging, waterproof coats, and carpets. The synthesized substances are called forever chemicals because they last a long time in the environment. Horwitt said, although a lack of information makes it difficult to know why the chemicals are used in drilling, he said it's likely they reduce friction in fracking and make it easier for the oil and gas to flow. The Environmental Protection Agency has recommended that PFAS level parts in drinking water not exceed 70 parts per trillion, but there are few restrictions on their use, said Sonia Lunder, the Boulder-based senior toxics policy advisor for the Sierra Club. While new EPA Administrator Michael Reagan has said he'll use every tool in the toolbox to regulate PFAS, Lunder expects it to be years before safeguards are put in place. Flying under the radar, a 2021 report by Physicians for Social Responsibility said PFAS had been used in 1,200 oil and gas wells in six states: Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Wyoming, because some states don't require companies to list the chemicals they use on Frac Focus. The organization said the use of PFAS is likely far more widespread than the database indicates. Colorado requires companies to post information on the chemical registry. However, like several other states, it allows companies to designate some substances as trade secrets. The director of the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission can reject a request to keep the chemicals makeup secret and can require the information to protect public health and the environment. The COGCC is taking a serious look at how this emerging issue may relate to oil and gas operations, spokeswoman Megan Castle said in an email. The State Water Quality Control Division isn't aware of any impact to drinking water from PFAS potentially used in fracking, spokeswoman Erin Garcia said. The division sampled 400 water systems in 2020 for PFAS, and none of the water tested above the federal advisory level, she said in an email. Companies that perform hydraulic fracturing invest time and money to develop processes and materials, and the formulas they use give them a competitive edge, said Lid Granger, executive director of American Petroleum Institute, Colorado. Protecting the trade secrets provides incentives for companies to invest in research and develop new products, including those that use less fresh water and more environmentally benign substances, Granger said in an email. Lunder said the state has done good work in Colorado to measure PFAS in drinking water by offering its services to local agencies across the state. She said one of the most striking cases of contamination is in the communities of Security Widefield and Fountain, southeast of Colorado Springs. Military officials tracked the spread of the chemicals from Peterson Air Force Base south to the communities where drinking water wells were contaminated. Lunder said before work by Physicians for Social Responsibility and the group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, the issue of PFAS chemicals used in drilling was really flying under our radar. We have this long list of places where we've seen PFAS contamination, industries that we know discharge PFAS, Lunder said. But this idea that the most potent and not toxic chemicals that we're dealing with nationally are used potentially in the oil and gas industry was actually quite a surprise. My only option is to speak out. Librarian says she was fired for objecting to cancellation of anti-discrimination programming by Elizabeth Hernandez. A Colorado librarian filed state and federal discrimination complaints Friday, alleging she was fired by a Weld County Library District after objection to the cancellation of programs she had planned for youth of color and LGBTQ teens, including an anti-racism workshop. Brookie Parks filed the complaints with the Colorado Civil Rights Division and the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission over her firing by the High Plains Library District in December, following a move to discourage inflammatory or polarizing programming. Parks said she believes she was terminated from her job at the Erie Community Library branch for advocating for youth of color and LGBTQ youth who are protected under the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act, and in retaliation for opposing unlawful discriminatory practices. If something is really, really wrong, I cannot support that, Parks told the Denver Post. If I were to stay quiet and just keep doing my job and let that happen, I feel like I'm part of the problem. My only option is to speak out. James Molina, a community relations and marketing manager for the High Plains Library District, said the decision to fire Parks was an internal matter that he could not discuss. Governed by a 7-member board of trustees, the High Plains Library District manages 7 branch libraries, including 2 in Greeley, and is affiliated with 6 autonomous member libraries. During a meeting on November 15th, the trustees approved programming policy language that states library programs, quote, should not be intended to persuade participants to a particular point of view, and the district does not present programs that are intentionally inflammatory or polarizing, close quote. Molina said High Plains policy was formalized at that meeting, but wasn't different from how the library already had been operating. Part of the drive behind formalizing the policy, he said, was in pursuit of becoming the first library district to win the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award, established by Congress to promote improved quality of goods and services in U.S. companies and organizations. When asked if those changes were in line with the award, Jennifer Huergo, Director of Public Affairs at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, noted, diversity, equity, and inclusion are a focus of the Baldrige Excellence Framework. The High Plains policy doesn't bar controversial programs, Molina said, but prompts staff to pay special attention to them and how they are executed. Molina said a manager would determine whether a program is controversial. As an example, we could host a program about gun control and gun rights and keep it informational, but if the program was intended to persuade attendees one way or the other, we would consider that controversial or polarizing, Molina said. In Park's written discrimination complaint, she wrote, I was afraid the new policy would be exploited to discriminate against minorities in our community, and it turns out I was right to be afraid. So fabulous at what she did. Parks was a teen librarian at the Erie branch for 3 years, developing and running programs that included a teen advisory board, Harry Potter escape rooms, suicide prevention workshops, and a book club called Read Woke, in which teens read one book per month focusing on different marginalized communities. Brookie was so focused and so dedicated and so fabulous at what she did, said Michelle Sparks, a library associate at the Erie branch. She was so good at being really sensitive toward understanding what it would take to get the teens to want to come in and hang out, or even better, participate in this teen advisory board. She was so good at thinking through and implementing what kind of programs the teens would be interested in that she was, in my opinion, doing more than I had seen anybody else previously do. Sparks was one of 6 Erie branch employees who corroborated Park's allegations in interviews with the Post. 2 days after the November policy changes were instated, Park said she was called into the office of her boss, Marjorie Elwood. According to Parks, Elwood said that due to the policy changes, Parks needed to rename her Read Woke book club because the word woke was polarizing. Parks said Elwood also directed her to cancel 2 upcoming programs, an anti-racism workshop for teens and an LGBTQ teen program called Resistance Through History and You. A children's librarian also was instructed to cancel a program because it featured the words social justice, Parks said. Molina said the programs were not canceled because they were never approved to begin with. When we were alerted to this, we began the process to correct it, Molina said. The rest was an internal HR matter. Molina said topics about LGBTQ youth and youth of color are not inherently polarizing, but the way each topic is presented can be. Molina said the library has a history of supporting such programs and will continue to host them when planned properly. Attorney Iris Halpern of the Denver-based Rath and Mohammed Hyatt law firm is representing Parks and said the librarian also intends to file a lawsuit alleging discrimination, retaliation, and violations of her First Amendment rights. It's nothing more than sheer racist ideology and homophobic ideology, and our public institutions should not be subscribing, Halpern said. It's sending the wrong message to minorities and saying their story doesn't matter and their identities need to be erased. Elected officials are not taking seriously their role in representing all their communities and constituents because it's politically popular right now to discriminate against minority groups as a political tool and an expedient way to gain favor at the ballot box. There's a sad history of this. And sending a message that you don't matter, Parks pushed back on the cancellation of her events. During the first week of December, Parks was supposed to have her annual performance evaluation, but instead was issued a written warning by Elwood and a human resources representative with negative feedback about her work, Parks said. She said she had never received a bad evaluation or written discipline prior to the situation. Parks used to write a rebuttal asked to write a rebuttal to her warning, but said she was fired one day after submitting it in mid-December. I was not put on any performance improvement plan and had no previous indication that my job was at risk, Parks wrote in her statement. Instead, the abruptness of the library's decision to raise all of these performance issues just after I began pressing the district on its discrimination policies suggested to me that my termination was purely retaliatory. Sparks, who is still employed at the Erie branch, said libraries need to be a safe place for all people. Our main concern is we are just doing that same old song and dance of let's play it safe as long as it's safe for the white people or the cisgender, Sparks said. If we ignore the disenfranchised and we ignore or intentionally mute ourselves in the area of the LGBTQ people or people of color, we're sending a message that you don't matter. The message that was sent when Brookie was fired was this is no longer a discussion. We aren't talking about it anymore, and you will toe the line. In Superior, to help host fire recovery conversations, to help inform the community planning effort, Superior town leaders said they are working with an outside consultant to facilitate a series of community conversations with residents who lost their home in the Marshall Fire. In a town news release, Superior stated this effort is intended to help provide information and targeted conversations on efforts that are currently underway or anticipated, and to understand resident and property owner interest in a range of possible strategies that could be pursued to help facilitate efficient and cost-effective redevelopment of affected areas. Town leaders encouraged residents to share their individualized and anonymous feedback through an online survey that will be available on the Superior's website, superiorcolorado.gov, on Monday. Hard copies will also be available at Superior Town Hall, 124 East Coal Creek. There will also be a virtual community meeting from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday over Zoom at us02web.zoom.us/j/88931430409. Now to sports. Bringing the defense. Jokic, Denver dominate. And three-game losing streak by Mike Singer. Nikola Jokic sat patiently on the scorer's table, waiting a few extra minutes before he was allowed to check in. Though he eventually returned with 5:21 left in the fourth quarter, the act was mostly cosmetic. The Nuggets snapped their three-game losing streak Sunday afternoon with a comfortable 124-104 win over the reeling Nets. Brooklyn dropped its eighth consecutive game, while the Nuggets, thanks to a quality defensive half, improved to 29-24 on the season. We talked at halftime, and I basically said, the first team that plays any defense is going to win the game, said Nuggets coach Michael Malone. The Nets managed just 29 points total in the second half. That's who we need to be, Malone said. It was only because of Jokic's late appearance that he solidified his NBA-leading 14th triple-double of the season. Jokic finished the afternoon with 27 points on 12-for-15 shooting, 12 rebounds, and 10 assists, dominating the game with his touch and efficiency. He paced the Nuggets, who finished with 37 assists. Of his team's defensive about-face, Jokic couldn't help but make fun of his team. Amazing, isn't it? Jokic said of Brooklyn's 75-point first half. Did we break a record? Aaron Gordon was stellar, pouring in 17 points, snatching 9 rebounds, and dishing 7 assists in addition to a steady defense on Kyrie Irving. Without Kevin Durant or James Harden available, Irving was the focal point of Brooklyn's attack. He managed 27 points, but on 10 of 26 from the field. Blake Griffin added 19, but was stymied in the second half after Malone made Jeff Green, not Jokic, his primary cover. DeMarcus Cousins played 16 quality minutes, registering 5 points and 9 rebounds. The Nuggets reserves added 35 points as a unit. Jokic broke Brooklyn in the third quarter. The Nets had no answers for his drop step or any of the other dazzling post moves the reigning MVP flexed. After hanging several quick buckets, he started picking the Nets apart with his passing. On one, after most of the damage had been done, he served up Gordon an easy dump-down pass for a jam. The 20-5 run, punctuated by three-pointers from Gordon and Will Barton, burst the game open. But more than Jokic's wizardry or Gordon's takeoffs, the best part of the quarter might have been their defensive effort. Barton chased down Nets forward Kessler Edwards for a momentum-swinging block, and Gordon momentarily bottled up Irving. The complimentary play earned the Nuggets a 107-91 lead heading into the fourth. "We had a really good film session Saturday," Malone said Sunday morning. Prior to getting into the film, it was talking about, "We had won 5 games in a row, then in February we're 0-3, and our defensive rating in February is 29th. It can't be just about let's turn the page and get ready for Brooklyn. It has to be, why were we 0-3? It boiled down to transition defense, point of attack defense, pick and roll defense, and protecting the paint. Malone, only half kidding, said the film session was the same one they'd seen for 52 games. At some point, when is enough enough, he wondered, questioning his team's penchant for admiring their shots rather than hustling back on defense. Sunday's first half offered a resounding, not yet. Defense was optional over the first 2 quarters as the Nuggets took a 76-75 lead into halftime. Denver shot 62%, setting up camp inside Brooklyn's paint for 40 first-half points. Jokic, who Malone implored to take more shots, had 18 points at halftime, including 14 in the second quarter alone. His slow-motion Euro step gave Nets defenders fits while unlocking the Nuggets' most effective offense. During the film session, Malone conveyed an essential message to Jokic. "Shoot the ball. You are a great player. We need you to take these shots." But to Malone's chagrin, the defense was non-existent. Led by 19 points each from Griffin and Irving, the Nets scorched from the three-point line. Their 12 first-half three-pointers kept the game close and encouraged a high-octane contest. "Cousins is grouch the Nuggets need," by Mark Kisla. DeMarcus Cousins is good trouble, precisely the ornery, disagreeable grouch the Nuggets need. "He proved me wrong," center Nikola Jokic said Sunday after his new bestie Cousins grabbed 9 rebounds, scored 5 points, and rubbed the Brooklyn Nets the wrong way during a 124-104 victory that allowed Denver to snap a 3-game losing streak. "Let's boogie." In the past, after bumping and grinding with Cousins on the court, Jokic said, "I always thought he's a bad person." But now, on the same side of the fight, Jokic had discovered he's actually a really good guy, fun to be around, great personality. Although the 10-day contract the Nuggets gave the controversial 4-time NBA All-Star has expired, Jokic and coach Michael Malone gave thumbs up to keeping Cousins around to crash the boards and be as irritable to foes as fingernails on the chalkboard. "I would love to be here," Cousins said. "I think it's a good fit. I think I can bring the energy to help push this team over the top." During his brief stint with Denver, Cousins has struggled to get healthy and did not shoot the ball well. His sneakers at times seemed stuck in cement. At age 31, he's not nearly the MVP-caliber player that Boogie used to be, a powerful force in the paint that caused one member of the U.S. Olympic team to confide to me back in 2016. "There were days at training camp when nobody at practice could stop Cousins. He has had a positive impact. You can't just look at him on a stat sheet," said Malone, who not only learned how to push the buttons of Cousins, but also deciphered when Boogie needed a hug back in the days when Sacramento was their shared NBA home. So what does the coach value in Cousins? "The rebounding, the defense, the toughness, the physicality, the edge that he brings, I think is tremendous," Malone said. "Yes, a reputation for disturbing the peace does precede Cousins. He has a temper. Can get a little bit crazy," Jokic noted, and refs have noticed. They refuse to take any guff from Boogie to the point where the big center can get charged with a foul for general grumpiness. Teammates who know Boogie love him. In the NBA universe, however, he was painted long ago in garish colors as a basketball villain. "It's frustrating, man," Cousins said. "It's hard when you live a narrative that you don't agree with, but this is a business that puts out narratives on people. Sometimes it's true, and sometimes it's not. All I can do is continue to push and try to be the best version of myself." After arm fighting with Nets reserve De'Ron Sharpe in the second half, which seemed like nothing more than a harmless and brief exchange of unpleasantries, Cousins got slapped with a triggered technical foul, his 4th in 5 appearances with Denver. "It's like beating a dead horse. It's obvious. I am who I am. I don't even get the fair end of the stick, Cousin said. And I'm viewed 100% differently than any other player in this league. Is it fair? No, but it's the situation that I'm in. I obviously absolutely hate it. I think it's unfair. It is what it is. Yes, Cousins would require constant care by Malone, not to mention an occasional dose of tough love. But here's the deal. Outside of perimeter shooting, the most glaring weakness of this Nuggets team is the lack of don't-mess-with-us glares. I hate to call these guys soft. The Nuggets do have Boy Scout tendencies, though. There's nothing wrong with being kind or courteous until push comes to shove in the playoffs. Nobody wants to get in a shoving match with Cousins. While he can't turn Denver into a legit title contender, he can make the Nuggets a pain in the butt. Denver has lacked a true backup center to take the load off Jokic since making the dollars and cents decision to part ways with JaVale McGee. It's more than a coincidence in the five games Cousins has suited up and taken the court, Denver has not lost. You take the time to actually know a person, Cousins said, and it can change your perspective. I say President of Basketball Operations Tim Connelly should sign Cousins for the remainder of the season and see what good trouble happens. I think he can help us, Jokic said. He's a big guy who is talented and can do a bunch of things on the floor. All you listening, Mr. Connelly? Let's boogie. Schifrin calls fall in giant slalom huge disappointment by Andrew Damp of the AP. Two-time Olympic gold medalist Michaela Schifrin's first trip down the race hill at the Beijing Games lasted just five turns and mere seconds Monday, ending in a disqualification from the opening leg of the giant slalom that she called a huge disappointment. The seventh racer on a course known as the Ice River at the Yangjing Alpine Skiing Center and the defending champion, the 26-year-old American, lost control coming around a left-turn gate, slid, and fell on her side. Eventually, she got up and stopped on the side of the slope, stuck her poles in the snow, and put her hands on her hips. The day was finished, basically, Schifrin said, before it even started. She still could have a handful of chances over the next 2 weeks to become the first alpine ski racer from the United States to win three Olympic golds across a career. Schifrin hopes to enter all five individual events in Beijing. I'm not going to cry about this, she said, because that's just wasting energy. Not long after her competitive day was done, hours earlier than expected, Schifrin headed back out to do some training for the slalom. That is her next event, scheduled for Wednesday. Schifrin won that at age 18 at the 2014 Sochi Games, part of a remarkable career that includes a total of three Olympic medals. There was a silver in the combined at the 2018 Pyeongchang Games, in addition to her triumph in the giant slalom there, three World Cup overall titles, and a half dozen World Championship golds. Like you can see, anything can happen, and it happens really, really quickly, she said Monday. Schifrin did not appear overly dejected or emotional by the time she came down the mountain and spoke to reporters. Then she hugged teammate Nina O'Brien and congratulated her on her sixth-place run. How surprising was this? Schifrin is as precise a skier as there is, someone who prides herself on making sure she gets all the way down the course, pushing just the right amount to be faster than everyone else while staying upright. No easy task while sending yourself down the icy side of a mountain. This was the first time she had failed to finish a giant slalom anywhere since January 23, 2018, in the Complutense World Cup event at San Vigilio di Marabi, Italy, a 30-race streak. That mistake came 3 weeks before she won the gold in South Korea. Schifrin arrived in China as one of the most watched athletes in any sport at the Winter Olympics, a superstar who has dominated ski racing for long stretches in recent years. Schifrin has spoken openly about the pressure created by the weight of expectations, her own, of course, and those of fans, but also coaches, friends, and family. She also is upfront about the burden of dealing with the accidental death of her father, Jeff, 2 years ago. The giant slalom was the first women's alpine race on the schedule in Beijing and Schifrin's first test. After slipping, she tried to right herself, but it was too late. Schifrin was hardly the only racer to encounter trouble Monday. She was one of 19 of the 80 starters who failed to finish the first run. Only skiers who complete that get a chance to go in the second run scheduled for later Monday. Marta Bassino of Italy, who won the World Cup against slalom title last season and went two spots earlier than Shiffrin on Monday, fell on her left hip, slid down, and spun around. Sarah Hector of Sweden, who leads the GS standings this season, led the way with a first-run time of 57.56 seconds, followed by Katrina Trupp of Austria at 57.86 and Federica Brignone of Italy at 57.98. Brignone was the bronze medalist in the giant slalom 4 years ago. And U.S. tunes up for Canada with Rout of Swiss. Having avoided questions about their heated cross-border rivalry all week because the focus has been on the next opponent, United States women's hockey coach Joel Johnson and his players could finally address what's been on everyone's mind since the Beijing Games opened. Bring on Canada. The defending Olympic champions worked out their remaining kinks with a dominating 8-0 win over Switzerland on Sunday to prepare for their Group A final against Canada on Tuesday. I think both teams think there's no doubt that we can win and both teams respect their opponent, but they have all the confidence in the world, Johnson said. I know that's how they're approaching it. I know that's how Canada is approaching it, and that's why it's going to be fun to watch. Hillary Knight scored 2 first-period goals. Alex Cavallini stopped 12 shots, and the Americans produced their most complete performance so far. Kelly Panik and Jesse Compher, sister of the Avs, TJ Compher, also scored twice on a night. 13 of 19 U.S. skaters earned at least a point. I was really happy with how we played. Just felt like we finally put together a full 3 periods, defender Lee Stecklin said. Looking forward to hopefully a practice day tomorrow, and then excited for Canada, as always. Broncos Reisner donates to help Monarch students recover by Kelsey Hammond of the Times Call. Broncos lineman Dalton Reisner hopes to be known for more than his actions on the football field. Sitting in the bleachers at the Monarch High School gym, Reisner shook hands with students and posed for photos at Saturday's basketball game before presenting a giant check for $5,000 to the high school. The funds will help this high school's athletic department provide program support to students impacted by the Marshall Fire. Monarch principal Neil Anderson said the school will be assessing what students who were impacted by the fire need so that they can still participate in the programs they want to be part of, whether that's helping them to buy equipment, gear, or cover fees. The one thing I want to leave you guys with today before you play some ball, I can't wait to watch it, is what's really important to me, Reisner said. That's not the football player I am. More importantly, it's the things I do off the field and the heart that I have, because that's what matters. Reisner shared with those gathered for the game Saturday that he's originally from Wiggins, a small town roughly 2 hours east. This is big-time ball up here, Reisner told the basketball players. I was playing 1A ball back there. I couldn't hang with these dogs and these dogs, he said, gesturing to each team. It's an honor for me to represent small-town Colorado. To raise money, Reisner auctioned off his football season's gear for himself and his team. Those who bid could find jerseys, cleats, gloves, and footballs. Items from Broncos players Bradley Chubb and Noah Fant were included in the mix. The auction raised $8,500. Reisner also contributed an additional $1,500 from his Reisner Up Foundation. With a total of $10,000, Reisner donated the other half of the funds to A Precious Child, a Broomfield nonprofit that assists children and families facing challenges such as abuse, neglect, crisis situations, and poverty. Anderson said he hoped that Saturday's check presentation shows students how much their community and beyond cares for them as their families recover from the Marshall Fire. Anderson said roughly 187 students at the high school were highly impacted by the fire. Being able to have someone like Dalton Reisner use his philanthropic actions to support our community's needs is pretty special and pretty phenomenal, Anderson said. He was able to get the other linemen on the Denver Broncos to also support this effort through the auctioning of their jerseys. With him being able to be here today, seeing that come together through his foundation and other partners on the Denver Broncos, it's really special. While Reisner isn't directly connected to the high school, Kevin Gale, a Monarch football and basketball coach, said he went to school in Nederland with Reisner's parents. Gale said he contacted Reisner to see if he could help. "I know Dalton is the type of guy that would help," Gale said, "so I reached out to him and he was like, yeah, let's do this." Reisner said he wanted the opportunity to present the check in person rather than just send it to the school. "If it sends a message at all, I hope it's that I love you and care about you," Reisner said. "We as humans need to care and love for each other more, especially in times like this." And thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.